From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we revisit an interview about some iconic and previously unknown photos of the civil rights era in northern cities. Then our Fit for You series learns more about the practice of acupuncture.
When you have the acupuncture needle inserted, sometimes you feel something, and if you do, it's usually going to be like a minor dull achiness, a little pressure. It's typically a very mild sensation. Sometimes you don't feel it at all.
And we'll hear some new music from some Milwaukee bands, including Gold.
This isn't really like so much upbeat, kind of glittery dance electro music. This is kind of darker, kind of heavier synthy electro music. And it's a style that they do really well and a style they've been slowly evolving into over the past few years.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. When we think about the modern civil rights era, there are many images that come to mind. Crowds of people holding signs, policemen attacking children with dogs and fire hoses, students sitting at lunch counters with jeering crowds behind them. For many Americans, these images form our view of that time period, and they frame the fight for civil rights as a largely Southern issue. But historian and author Mark Spelt wanted to change that image. His 2016 book, North of Dixie, features images from cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Milwaukee during the civil rights era. Speltz is a senior historian at American Girl and a graduate of UWM. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio back in 2016 to talk about the way the photos impact our understanding of history and his inspiration for this book.
Well, I started at UWM and I was taking a visual culture and photography class in 2007. And we were asked to select a photograph and interpret it and interrogate and talk about it. And I knew I wanted to do civil rights photography. I've always been incredibly moved by the compelling and powerful photographs. And so when I was looking at some iconic photographs from 1963 of a sit-in in Jackson, Mississippi. And I then, in my other hand, at the UWM archives, held a Milwaukee photograph from August 1967. And I had never seen it before. And I looked at it, and there was an interracial group of marchers, the NAACP, Milwaukee Youth Council, marching through the South Side. But there were police officers with guns pulled, pointing to the air, escorting them through. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why are they doing that? And what I came to learn was they were going through this neighborhood and they were intensely angry about it and throwing rocks and bags of urine and firecrackers. Whites from the sidewalks did not like this intrusion, this protest. And it was incredibly contested. So the photograph opened up a whole new world for me that I wasn't aware of, the civil rights movement in the North. My advisor was working on the 40th anniversary celebrations at the time. So open housing, conferences, there were oral history projects. And I began to understand what this meant to the community and how the photographs we see now help us understand that time period.
Having learned history of the civil rights era in Wisconsin, I can say that most of the images I remember, they are from places like Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas. When I came to Milwaukee, I was surprised to learn things about the civil rights history. And I think part of that is the lack of imagery and kind of the lack of conversation. Do you think the two play into one another? Like the lack of images is part of why we don't talk about it as much?
I think that's exactly right. You don't see them in textbooks. Our textbooks tell a very Southern story. They tell a very aggressive, violent story with the photographs. You see people being attacked. You see brutalized black bodies. You don't see African Americans standing up and making change themselves. You don't often see images that show agency. You see them, you know, being washed down a sidewalk in Birmingham. Or you see a very charismatic male leader speaking at, you know, the March on Washington. Those are the pictures you see. Now, kids in Milwaukee, they might come across a few pictures in local textbooks or local packets. But once you move out further, I grew up in Minnesota. I had never seen those photographs before. I wasn't familiar with what happened in Chicago. And I don't think that that's necessarily the fault of educators or maybe even textbook writers. I think it's how we've been trained to think about the civil rights movement, both from when it was happening to now, how we educate our children. While it was happening, the press, the Northern press, would much rather point a finger at the Southern part of the nation. It was easier to frame. It was easier storylines to follow. It made you feel better about your own communities. But these same issues and more, and some that were more pervasive, were, you know, boiling up and boiling over in the neighborhoods. I think that the Northern press, when they did have to cover it, they covered it in a very similar way. Like on Milwaukee's newspapers, you would see whites rioting, you'd see tear gas, you'd see angry whites fighting with the police. But what you didn't see were the marchers themselves very often. In fact, in the first 2 weeks, over 75% of the photographs featured whites, police, politicians like the mayor, but not Father Grappi and the African-American youth who were leading the struggle. So I think that that's part and parcel for how the community covered it. If you're going to cover it, it focused on the most attention-grabbing issues. Other times it would be buried to the back pages.
Do we know why that is?
I think that it's a lot of, you know, you don't want to make your community look real bad. Now, I think students today, if they see these photographs in textbooks nationally, they'll start to understand that the struggle was coast to coast. They'll see that ordinary Americans, like their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents, took part in these types of struggles. They didn't wait for Dr. King to come to their community or some other well-known civil rights leader. They made change on their own. These struggles were built, conceived of, and waged locally by ordinary Americans.
When we look at the images in the book, especially of Chicago, a lot of the Art Shea images, to me, it seems like we're looking at people in the South. You know, in one, they're holding Confederate flags. You know, they're screaming in this way that we think of as being so indicative of these images from Alabama and Mississippi. And in that same way, when we look at the images from Milwaukee, we have that same kind of sense, at least in my mind. And both of these cities are still dealing with this kind of lasting segregation. How do these images help us fill in kind of our cultural knowledge gaps about our own cities?
I think seeing the photographs of people from Milwaukee or Chicago holding Confederate flags and angry at civil rights protesters, they complicate our understanding of the civil rights struggle, how we remember it. We think of it as a celebratory tale. There are many things to celebrate, important speeches, important legislative acts, and really important moments. But when we bring the North into the picture, it complicates it. There's a lot of things that are left undone, issues that we still grapple with. And I think that the photos give us that historical context. So if you grow up thinking, you know, freedom in the North wasn't the promised land that we like to think it was. There were an incredible amount of issues that blacks dealt with. There was housing segregation, workplace discrimination. There was over-policing and poor police and community relations, urban renewal. There was poor city services and trash collection, things that people dealt with in their daily life. So I think that the pictures and whites' reaction to people protesting change the way you look at it. And that helps us reassess our assumptions about the past.
A lot of what you mention, specifically urban renewal, a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, they're these things that can't always be pictured. And there isn't always an image associated with it. Do you think that that affects our ability to understand these issues?
I think the photographs that you see coming out of the North had to work a lot harder to visualize and make visible certain issues. You couldn't capture a lender saying no to somebody at a bank. I mean, I looked. I searched through JET looking for those African-American families outside of a bank, well-dressed, but unhappy because they couldn't get a loan photos. They didn't really exist. But I did find pictures from Look magazine in Philadelphia where you saw that same family walking into a neighborhood and staring at a house that they just loved and it fit what they wanted. There was a for sale sign out front, yet they knew they couldn't buy in that particular neighborhood. So photographers worked very hard to capture that sentiment, that feeling. Now, the way that activists could really make the issue visible was by marching onto the South Side in Milwaukee or through a different part of Chicago where they knew they would get a reaction. And that reaction would then get into the newspapers and onto the television news and call attention to the issue. Now, in Milwaukee, we see that the activists themselves are not what the focus is on after the first 2 weeks of the struggle here, the open housing struggle in 1967. The press tended to focus on everybody but them. But they still raised attention and called attention to the issue, which is important. I think when we look at the Southern photographs, it's very easy to see four students sitting at a lunch counter and not being served. And they're just sitting there politely and reading a book and studying. They're nonviolent. They're not getting any help. Or on the other side, you can see people sitting there and having ketchup and mustard poured all over them, sugar poured over their heads, people threatening them, very dangerous situation. Those ones are very easy to read. You know exactly what's going on. Now in the North, when you marched into a neighborhood, you know, that picture from Milwaukee with police guards with guns drawn, escorting a group through a neighborhood, that's not a quick read. You're not sure what's going on there. And they're not as black and white and as easy to read as the Southern photos.
So what are the images that we're going to see from Milwaukee in your book, North of Dixie?
Well, I included about three or four. There's a really strong one from Jet magazine that I like a lot, and it shows Dick Gregory, Val Phillips, and Father Groppi. And they're all looking back at the march and looking at some of the counter-protesters. But there's a steely look of determination on each of their faces. And I've always loved that photograph. It ran in Jet magazine right after the marches. Jet magazine covered Milwaukee for about 3 to 4 consecutive weeks. A lot of photographs were there. Those were seen by over 500,000 subscribers. And then that magazine was passed around, you know, at church and in barbershops. So Milwaukee's struggle was seen nationally. But it's not necessarily remembered nationally today like other Southern struggles. Another one of my favorite photos in the book, I came across it early on during my research. It ran, I think, on the third day of the struggles. There were arrests outside of the Freedom House after it had been burnt out. There's this incredible photograph of a woman who's in one hand holding her purse and a police officer's baton. Her right hand is straight up in his face, pushing him away. And what this photograph said to me 50 years later was, not everybody chose to go smoothly. Not everybody was willing to be lifted limply into a paddy wagon. Nonviolence was chosen by many, but not everybody. She was willing to struggle. She was willing to fight. And this ran on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal. Now, not everybody read the journal, but I think that a lot of people saw it and were inspired by her actions and came out to join the marches after that. In fact, I heard that from several people who were active in the marches, that photographs of arrest scenes, police interactions were inspiring. They did make them want to come out.
So why is this a conversation that you're resurrecting 50 years later? Why is this a conversation that is still important?
I think this is an incredibly important book for two reasons. Number one, it provides a lot of context to what we're seeing today. So I think nationwide, the book helps provide historical context to what we're seeing now on a whole range of issues. I think it also provides hope and is inspiring. The photos help people understand that it wasn't civil rights leaders taking every step, planning every campaign. All the local campaigns were led locally. They were fought locally, and they were either won or lost locally. And many of them continue yet today.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Speltz is the author of North of Dixie, Civil Rights Photography Beyond the South. He's also a senior historian at American Girl, and he lives in Madison. Our interview with him first aired in 2016. Coming up next, our Fit for You series travels to Milwaukee Community Acupuncture in Bayview. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. For all the possible ways human bodies can fall ill, there are even more ways to treat them. Many of us combine Western allopathic medicine with things like meditation and other holistic approaches. Well, acupuncture is one of those practices. It's been used in Chinese medicine for thousands of years as a method of treatment. Very fine needles are used, and they're inserted into specific points on the body, into the muscle tissue just below skin level. Studies by both the National Institutes of Health and the World Health Organization found that acupuncture is effective in helping health conditions, including stress, neurological conditions, body pain, depression, and anxiety. It's also used preventatively, but the practice is still somewhat controversial in the West, and often insurance in the United States doesn't cover it. This month's Fit for You segment will look past many people's fear of needles to find out more. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski went to Milwaukee Community Acupuncture in Bayview to meet its co-founders and practitioners, Amy Severinson and Olive Crane. Severinson begins by explaining the basics.
Acupuncture is the insertion of fine, sterile, single-use needles into points on the body that are located along meridians of energy found throughout the body. So by tapping into those points, the idea is that we're actually drawing energy either to or from certain locations of the body, allowing you to operate and feel your best. The origins are a little bit unclear, but we do know that there's written record all the way back to 100 BC.
So it's been a tried and true method for quite some time.
Exactly. It's been around for a minute.
Yeah. So a lot of people have a fear of needles, whether it's getting shots from the doctor or they picture themselves being stuck with a bunch of needles on a chair and they think, I don't think that'll be relaxing, or, you know, there's a lot of trepidation around it. So can you describe the types of needles that are used in acupuncture?
Yeah, so the needles that we use here, they're very thin, fine needles. They're made of stainless steel and they're solid. So the sensation that you get with an acupuncture needle insertion is much different than what you feel with a hypodermic needle. When you have the acupuncture needle inserted, sometimes you feel something, and if you do, it's usually going to be like a minor dull achiness, a little pressure. It's typically a very mild sensation. Sometimes you don't feel it at all. People are oftentimes surprised at how mild the sensations are, or the fact that I'll put several needles in and they haven't felt any of them. And surprisingly, we get a lot of people in that are terrified of needles, and they usually tell us that we work with them. And they're often surprised at how painless the procedure is.
So, yeah, I want to go into that. Some of the common misconceptions people have about this treatment. What is usually the biggest barrier from getting people into this room?
That you have to believe in it for it to work or know how it works. It's just not true. We have people who come in all the time who tell us that, oh, my goodness, you know, I've been here coming here now for 6 visits, and I didn't believe this was going to do anything at all. And now it's I'm feeling better. I'm walking out of here. I'm just amazed that it's working because I didn't think it would work.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe in a negative way, that this is often a last resort for people when they're just tired of more traditional medicine, either prescriptions or physical therapy or various other treatments?
Yeah, it's common for us to see people who have are feeling like they've exhausted all the other options. They've tried everything, nothing has worked. So they come in here and they'll say, I don't know if this is going to work or not. I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to try it because I don't have anything else to turn to at this point.
We have a lot of doctors in pain management clinics that are referring to us as well when they've exhausted all the other treatment options with their patients. And they'll say, well, give acupuncture a try. We've heard good things. So.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think we need to go to make that step even sooner, where it's not a last resort? Where is, quote, modern medicine in its view of acupuncture and, you know, essentially prescribing it as a treatment in a way?
Well, it's becoming a lot more common recently, especially with the opioid epidemic. There's a lot of new research coming out that is supporting acupuncture as a viable treatment for managing pain. And now with doctors changing their prescription habits with cutting back on opioid use, a lot of people actually are sending people to acupuncturists before trying painkillers. So things are changing right now. It's becoming more and more accepted among the Western medical field to suggest acupuncture as a treatment option.
But obviously with Eastern medicine, this is common practice. As you mentioned, what, 100 BC was its first?
Exactly, yes.
So do you think the Western culture just has a lot of catching up to do when it comes to more holistic care?
Well, the philosophies that acupuncture is born in are just really different than how we have tended to look at the body and health in general, but it's definitely becoming a more acceptable way of looking at things. You know, now doctors and all sorts of therapists will say that stress is a major contributor to health. And that's one of the things that we see all the time. Acupuncture is good at reducing stress levels and therefore helping the body to heal itself. And just reducing someone's stress in their life can do wonders in the body being able to heal itself.
So we've gone over treatment for pain, for stress. What other things, both internal, whether people think of more muscular pain or even up to GI tract problems or things, what range does acupuncture have in treating our bodies?
So you can use acupuncture to treat almost any condition or to support treatments of most conditions. We see a lot of pain, like you referenced, but we see a lot of emotional and mental health concerns. We treat insomnia, we treat digestive issues, respiratory issues. We have people coming in that are coming down with a cold or getting over a cold, sinus infections. We also see a lot of women and men for infertility and supporting people along that process as well and throughout pregnancy.
So it sounds like a lot of things that people probably wouldn't think of.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. So when it comes to body awareness, with regard to, you mentioned the energy, the pressure points. So for example, you could be putting a needle in someone's hand for back pain, but have you noticed that your patients get more body awareness, start to understand how things are connected a little better when they see something at first that doesn't make sense, but then they feel the results?
It's amazing when you put needles in people's hand or foot and they say, oh, I feel that right in the spot that I'm getting the pain. It's amazing. Or maybe that comes halfway through their treatment where they'll feel like a dull aching sensation or some other sort of sensation in the area that's totally remote to where we're putting the needles. I also feel like as people are able to rest and recuperate more, they start to feel more capable to make healthier lifestyle choices and things like that. It just starts to all become this snowball effect of wanting to do more for yourself. And once you start feeling better, you're able to do that.
Is acupuncture and dry needling the same thing?
So dry needling is essentially a style of acupuncture that we were trained in called orthopedic acupuncture. However, when people are referring to dry needling, what they're typically referring to is needling that is done by either a physical therapist or a chiropractor. There is some crossover with acupuncture, but they are not trained in the same theory that we are of understanding the entirety of the systems of the meridian systems and the energetic systems of Chinese medicine.
Now, with physical and emotional health components, obviously you guys have created a very open, calming space for people's treatments, which I'm sure, even before needles goes in, can help someone get into the right headspace and a little bit less stressed. So do you think acupuncture just also encourages us to make the time for ourselves, for our treatment, for our bodies, and that in addition helps how your patients feel?
Yeah, for sure. So here we really encourage people to rest for about 40 minutes with needles in. So coming here, you know, they have to wait in the lobby for a few minutes before they're able to come on back, usually if they're here early. And then they get into a chair, they wait for us to come over, we chat for a few minutes, but it's already, you know, calm and relaxing. They're already here for a few minutes, their heart rate's starting to come down. Once the needles go in, they're able to really get into that rest and recuperate, and they're here for 40 minutes generally with needles in. And that really starts to set in. It's like training your body to meditate, basically. And it gets easier, too. For some people, they have a hard time sitting still. You know, they want to, like, bring a book, be really active during their treatment. But we really encourage people to just try to be in that stillness for as long as they can. And if they're only able to do that 20 minutes, then that's okay, too.
Now, we are in a nice open room. There's a couple open rooms here, all with recliners kind of circling each other. So you mentioned encouraging that stillness in people. Is it hard for people to do that if we're in a shared space, or do you encourage talking to your neighbor? What kind of things are you setting up during these treatments?
So our space is a quiet space. We always have white noise machines in the background. We have music on at a low level. So when you come in, even though you will sit down and talk to an acupuncturist, we talk pretty quietly. So really you can't hear your neighbors, even if you're right next to somebody. We don't encourage talking, but sometimes it does happen. but we try to keep it pretty quiet just because everybody is in a state of relaxation when they're here, and we want to encourage that as much as possible.
Now, there's also just a fiscal and an economic business decision in setting up your space like this. So can you explain why it's Milwaukee Community Acupuncture?
So the business model really operates on high volume. So we're able to charge less per treatment. So we charge on a sliding scale of $15 to $40. People are able to choose where they are on that payment scale. And by lowering that payment scale, we just have to make sure that we're seeing more patients in an hour to make up for that. Most average rate hour-long sessions for acupuncturists would be around $50 to $100. So we just have to make sure that we're making that amount of money in that amount of time.
Mm-hmm. And how many chairs are here? How many people at max can you treat?
We have 20 chairs, and we do occasionally max out.
So kind of going along how Western medicine views some more holistic practices and Eastern practices, where do we have left to fill the gaps? What do you think can be done to improve people's views of acupuncture, or just simply improve the level of education about this? And what would be some words of encouragement for people who are just still a little trepidatious about it?
I think the biggest thing is to just give it a try. We have a lot of people that come in here and they don't necessarily know what they want to work on, and that's okay. People can come in and just try acupuncture, see how it feels, and oftentimes, you know, then you can kind of see how it might fit into your life or lifestyle, or just talking with the acupuncturist, you may be able to identify areas in which it can help you. And first and foremost, as Amy said earlier, it's really great at treating stress, which most people deal with. So that is huge just in and of itself. And I think that the amount of people in the U.S. that get acupuncture is really, really low. So there's a lot of room for improvement as far as just promoting acupuncture as a viable treatment alternative to other treatments available.
I wanted to say, too, that sometimes people feel really scared or trepidatious of the community setting. They feel a little bit nervous that there's going to be other people in the room, that it's not going to be as private. They won't get the same level of care as if they were just one-on-one in a room with a practitioner. And just the fact that there'll be other people in the room, too, can feel a little bit scary. But in such a time of, like, social isolation, people are so just tuned into, you know, their phones and what's going on in their personal life. This can be a really beautiful growing opportunity, too, for people to come into here and to feel comfortable in a setting with other people just a few feet away from them, resting and sleeping in a chair. How often do you rest and nap next to strangers? It's pretty beautiful. One of my favorite parts of the clinic is just stepping back and looking out in the treatment room and seeing all the people sleeping next to each other, resting, all doing the same thing for themselves, just focusing on themselves, but in a community space. It's really beautiful.
So what made you both want to get into this practice and then make it available for other people?
I was drawn to acupuncture because I had had acupuncture treatment myself. I started seeing an acupuncturist in college for migraines. I started getting migraines when I was 9 and had them on and off, and then they became more frequent when I was in college, and there weren't a lot of great treatments for it. I had medication, but it was very expensive, and so it was the only thing that really helped me to manage that. I had really great success with acupuncture, and then I again started getting acupuncture after college and started becoming more interested in the theory behind it, learning about it, and that's kind of how I was drawn to go back to school and study acupuncture. As far as the community setting, I started practicing community style right after school, and I was very drawn to that just because of making acupuncture more affordable and accessible to everybody. I really love acupuncture, and I wanted to offer it in a way that anybody could get it and not have that be limited by cost, which it often is. So this felt like the right setting for me to practice it.
So I read about acupuncture and decided to start the program on a whim, kind of, but I'd grown up with chiropractic and massage as a young dancer. I had a lot of body aches and pains, and so I was already familiar with some alternative style treatments, but acupuncture just seemed really beautiful to me and whole body balanced. I like the idea of it kind of merging like art and science and theory all together into one. It really spoke to me, and it also has an herbal component to it too, which I really liked as well. And so I finished the program and started a private practice up in Glendale, which was going well, but I saw this common problem that people were coming, they were getting their acupuncture, they were feeling better, and then they would have a talk with me about how they had to stop coming in because they just couldn't afford it anymore. I also had a number of friends and family that just wouldn't come to see me because they couldn't afford my practice, and even though I constantly offered to give them free treatments, whatever they needed, it felt like charity to them, and they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to belittle me or my practice, and so I decided I needed to do something different, that everyone could feel comfortable coming and getting treatment.
Amy Severinson and Olive Crane are the co-founders of Milwaukee Community Acupuncture. In addition to the practitioners, Audrey also spoke with two patients who talked about their experiences with the practice.
My name is Victor, and I'm being a patient here for almost 6 months.
My name is Alan, and I've been here for a year and a half.
So we have a beginner and more of an experience level. So Alan, we'll start with you. What brought you to acupuncture?
I was developing a fairly severe arthritis in my neck, and I didn't know how I was going to cure it, and I didn't want it to continue. A very good friend of mine said, well, you should try acupuncture. And I said, well, fine, I'll do that. And I said, where do you go? And he said, Milwaukee Community Acupuncture. I said, so I signed up, came in here, and been here ever since. And it's manageable. It's helped my range of motion, so it's been working for me.
What was your level of frustration with some of the more traditional medicine practices you were doing before coming to acupuncture? Was it a lot of physical therapy, medications for arthritis, things like that?
Well, I never got to that stage. And the doctor, my doctor said, well, just do your neck exercises and it'll be better. Well, it didn't get better. And my dad had it pretty seriously, and he got to the point where his range of motion was practically none. And I didn't want to get there.
And how about for you, Victor? When did you start coming?
I started coming here because around June of 2019, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Before I started going to medical treatment, I decided to do some acupuncture because I know that it's going to, in the past, it helped me with anxiety and stress. So, but unfortunately, it's expensive in many places. So when I discovered this place and I know how they work, I mean, I decided to start coming here and prepare for my surgery. I think the day before my surgery, I was here getting a treatment. I went to surgery 2 days later. I came back here after my surgery, so continue my treatment here, and it's been great. I mean, I think emotionally it's way better than any medication that can help you with. And I'm normally here like twice a week as a part of my maintenance, as I call it, because you know, unfortunately, many people they don't see that because they're more used to take medication. I'm trying not to take medication. I'm more like trying to be here and relax and have a good nap when I come here.
Now, it's two men coming here for acupuncture, and usually there's a stereotype that men are not as open to alternative treatments, to trying something new. They want to go the more traditional route. So have you shared your experience with others who maybe kind of dismiss acupuncture or dismiss other treatments?
I have mentioned it to people who I think have an issue that this might be helpful to. Other than that, I have not shared it.
Mm-hmm. I think what is very important is in order to do acupuncture, you got to believe in it. You don't believe in it, it's not going to work for you. I mean, nothing is going to work. I mean, so far I brought my girlfriend who was used to really afraid about needles. She couldn't see it, and I brought it, and she's a patient out here. I brought my niece who was experiencing some anxiety issues, and She's not coming very often because she's busy in school, but she's coming here. I know that this is working for me, and I want other people to have the experience, and hopefully they can get their health issues fixed and they feel better.
So compared to when you both first started coming, to having regular treatments and truly feeling the difference, what things do you feel if for some reason you can't get in your regular treatments, whether it's travel, work, things like that? For you, how important is it for you to be here consistently?
I think for me, mentally, it keeps me calm, knowing that I'm going to have my acupuncture. When they start feeling, they start experiencing any feelings of anxiety or stress, I mean, believe me, as soon as I come here and I get my treatment, I'm going to leave the place in peace and feel energized and be better. So I think sometimes when we're healthy, when we don't have any issues, we don't notice that. And sometimes, I mean, I start like take a pause and say, hey, I haven't feel like bad as I used to feel like months ago because my treatment not working. So, I mean, that's something I'm planning doing like for years as part of my health maintenance here.
Have your doctors that have helped you with your cancer care noticed a difference or have commented on it?
Yeah. I mean, yes or no. I mean, sometimes some doctors, they are not open to other kind of alternatives. And my doctor so far, he said that acupuncture may help or not, but he's not completely open to it. But I mean, it's my health, and I believe it's working for me, so I'm keep doing it. And but I mean, thank God my cancer now is, I just gotta go back to the doctor next week to get the final check, but everything is looking pretty good. So I'm gonna be pretty much cancer free pretty soon.
Great, I certainly hope so. And Alan, for you.
Well, I actually arrange my schedule around this because I think it's very important to come in here, and I'm on this once a week maintenance program. And not only did it help me with my neck, I have my range of mobility back, and it's tolerable pain now still. But what I found out, the worst part of getting older is the ability to heal. And I'm pretty active, and I'm hurting myself periodically. And I have found over the last year and a half that these little injuries that I get, they heal much faster than they used to. And I'm totally sold on this. But as Victor says, this is a faith-based operation. You have to believe in it, and it's not a quick fix. Most people will want to see an instant reaction, and you aren't going to get that. You have to believe in it, and it has to be ongoing.
That was Alan and Victor, patients from Milwaukee Community Acupuncture. Earlier in the interview, we heard from the practice's co-founders, Amy Severinson and Olive Crane. To explore more of our Fit for You segments, go to WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then return with some new Milwaukee music curated by Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Matt Wild is a co-founder of Milwaukee Record, which he and fellow co-founder Tyler Moss describe as an online source for music, culture, and of course, gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things that Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Matt is the curator of that list, and since last August, we've been having him come in to share some samples of what he's been listening to. We call it Milwaukee Music Roundup, and Matt joins me in the studio. Matt Wild, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing well.
Good. I understand you came down with a dreaded flu, but you're kind of upright and moving.
I am. I was dead for a few days, and now I'm alive once again.
You have risen.
It feels good to be alive among the living, listening and talking about Milwaukee music.
Milwaukee music. Did you have a chance to listen while you were sick, or did
no?
You not?
I was just saying off air, like I had a chance to do nothing while I was sick. I was like, at first, I thought, oh, I'd catch up on some reading or something. No, it was just I was literally dead. So
okay,
it's great to be back.
All right. Well, you have a really great lineup for this month, starting with Gold.
Gold. Yes, the one, the only Gold. One of the big success stories to come out of Milwaukee in recent years. They were born I believe from a Milwaukee a Halloween show, a one-off Halloween show back in 2013 or so. And they've since gone on to be become a very successful kind of electro dance pop outfit. They're no longer based in Milwaukee. I believe they're out of Baton Rouge these days, back where the lead singer, her name is Margaret Butler. I believe she's from Baton Rouge. So they're based there now, but they're back in Milwaukee often. They put out a ton of music. Milwaukee knows them, loves them, and they have a new song out, and it's called Welcome to My House. And
is it from an album? Or
it is from an upcoming album. The name of the album is called Here We Are. That's due February 14th, Valentine's Day. And they'll be playing a local release show March 27th at Turner Hall. And what I really like about this song, and I assume the upcoming album, this isn't really like so much upbeat, kind of glittery dance electro music. This is kind of darker, kind of heavier synthy electro music. And it's a style that they do really well and a style they've been slowly evolving into over the past few years. And I really, really like it. And like I said, yeah, check them out. They'll be playing here March 27th. They play in Milwaukee often. You'll often see them around. So it's great to hear new music from them. And this is the newest, Welcome to My House.
That's Gold, Welcome to My House. And you know, you're right, it's not dark, mm-hmm. but it's more introspective,
yeah.
is what I thought when I listened to it. It's like they're really kind of looking inward a little bit.
Yeah, it's not so much a bubblegummy kind of dancey pop, but it's a bit darker, a bit heavier. The record I should mention is produced by Malachi DeLorenzo from the band Langhorne Slim, also the son of Milwaukee's own Victor DeLorenzo. From original drummer of the Violent Femmes.
That's right, who's actually sat in this studio, and we've had great conversations.
Victor is a
yes.
terrific fellow.
Terrific guy. So, well, we move to Stephen Strupp, who couldn't be more different from Gold.
Exactly, yeah. This is, yeah, you'll, the theme of this this show is just, we're up and down here. There is no theme, I should say. Stephen Strupp, a very prolific Milwaukee musician. He's played, probably best known for his work with the band Sat Night Duets. Played with them for many, many years, a great indie rock band in Milwaukee. And since then, since leaving that band, he's been putting out a lot of music under a new band called Soda Road. And also, he has kind of this jokey country band called the Blue Mooners. I would highly suggest listeners check out the Blue Mooners. It's a delight if you're
just for the name.
If you're a fan of like Roger Miller kind of country,
perfect.
You'll dig
yep.
the Blue Mooners. But Stephen has, I think, for the first time, some new music out under his own name, some solo music, and this is from a 30-track album called "The Rest of My Time." The song we're going to listen to is called More, and this is a very, very chill, very, very quiet acoustic music. Feels like it was recorded, you know, in his bedroom. Fans of, you know, Elliot Smith or something, I think, would really like that. If you have that itch, this is something you really need to listen to. Like I said, it's a big album. It's a very somber, very sad, introspective album. Each song kind of bleeds into the other. Most of the songs are only maybe a minute, 2 minutes tops. So it's definitely an album you really want to sit down and kind of let wash over you. It is actually an album that I was listening to while I was sick. So it's not to say it's a great album to listen to when you're dying, but it's
just in case you are.
It's one of those albums you want to wrap yourself in a blanket and listen to the whole thing.
All right.
So the song we're going to be listening to is called More.
Might be something better out there, but can you know for sure? Till you've opened every door, you'll be wondering if you found it. And what's more, might have had it before. Same old jokes get old and tired.
Stephen Strupp with More. And, you know, I just love that very stripped down acoustic. It almost sounds like a ukulele. I don't know that it is, but, you know, yeah. And it's just, it invites you to sit down and really pay attention.
Yeah. And it's an album that feels like it was recorded all in like one session. Like he was just sitting there and just like got it all out in one session. So it's a beautiful album.
Well, tell me about this next one, Vins Clortho.
Vins Clortho. This is a pretty new band. They came out last year in Milwaukee. They take their name from the character from Ghostbusters, Vins Clortho, the Keymaster of Gozer, played by Rick Moranis, of course. But they are not a Ghostbusters novelty band, sadly.
That's too bad, because there is a niche that needs to be filled.
That's right. So I'm working on that myself. So.
Good.
The band is, Vins Clortho is head up by Victor Buell. He is a singer and a musician in another band in town called Calliope. And all the other members of the band, too, are, it's a super group of sorts, you might say. Members from bands like Mortgage Freeman, Miles Coyne is in Vins Clortho. Miles Coyne himself is in 8,000 local bands. And when Vins Clortho first came out last year with a handful of singles, they were kind of this very dusty, kind of bluesy, kind of David Lynchy bluesy kind of band. That's the kind of sound they had. If you would go to the Twin Peaks Roadhouse, this is the kind of music you would hear. So it's interesting that this new song, which is called "Like a Ghost," is kind of a big turn for them. Like Gold, it's kind of a darker, moodier, synthier kind of sound, and it's very interesting. It's an interesting turn from them. Like I said, they're a very new band, so maybe just kind of figuring out their sound as they go. But I really dig this sound for them. This is Vins Clortho, Like a Ghost.
Floating in the darkness of shadows.
Vins Clortho, Like a Ghost. And you know, you said there was no theme to this, but I think introspection and kind of moody seems to be the theme.
I'll go with that. I like that. I love finding out themes as we go along.
We've done this before.
It's always the best.
It is. So how do the Frogs with Hellsville Baby fit into our theme?
Well, where do we begin with the Frogs? This is another example of new old Milwaukee music. Of course, the legendary Frogs. A band that was founded in 1980, in the early 80s in Milwaukee, by brothers Jimmy and Dennis Flemion. They played around town for many years, a very provocative, very transgressive band, both on record and on stage. On stage, known for wearing, these kind of big, giant bat wings on stage and just being very outrageous. And into the 90s, they became kind of more well-known for, like, having famous fans. Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam was a big supporter of theirs. Billy Corgan was a big fan of theirs. Kurt Cobain, like, all that kind of crew back then really loved the Frogs, even though they were beloved in Milwaukee, but, you know, really didn't break out huge. Beck sampled them on one of his albums, That Was a Good Drum Break from Where It's At. That's the Frogs. So this album that is just being released, or it's actually being released in April, is kind of their long-lost debut album. They did have an official debut album come out in 1988. This one was recorded in 1986 and was they decided to shelve it because there was too much reverb on it. They didn't like it. And so 34 years later... I believe Jimmy Flemion figured out how to take off the reverb. He kind of shopped it around, and they've been working on it for a while and kind of have it.
Well, I thought
up
you were
to...
going to tell me that he fell in love with the reverb after 30 years.
No, they chiseled it away, and they're like, all right, it's good enough. The song yeah we're going to listen to is Hellsville Baby. I have not heard this entire album yet, but this one's available now. Like I said, the album comes out officially April 3rd, and this is delightful. And I've always admired the Frogs. My old band played with the Frogs. We got stiffed by the Frogs when we opened for them. They were supposed to pay us like $50. They gave us like $5. I felt that was like a real rite of passage for us. I was like, oh, wow, we made it. We got stiffed by the Frogs.
Speaking of Hellsville, right?
Yeah, so here we are, Hellsville Baby from the Frogs' long-lost debut album.
Hellsville Baby, you can take this town and burn the whole thing down. Nothing's lost because nothing's found, you see, in a town as dead as me. Hicksville, baby, you can take our town and tear the whole thing down. Nothing's lost because nothing's found, you see, in a town as dull as me. Isn't it dull?
The Frogs with a new old album. And that was a theme, too, because I think last time we talked, we also, there was an album that, like, surfaced.
Oh, I believe the Haskells,
yes.
Long-lost debut mm-hmm. album as well. So Milwaukee's just loaded with these things.
Long-lost debut albums floating around in basements somewhere. But that's a lot of fun, and it's very much of its time.
Yes, it really is. And I should say that Jimmy is touring behind some of these songs. Along with Evan Dando, they are kind of combining as the Frogs. His brother Dennis sadly passed away tragically in 2012, and so Jimmy and Evan Dando are going on tour as the Frogs, beginning February 14th. Again, Valentine's Day.
It's a perfect Valentine's Day gift for the music lover in your life.
Absolutely.
So, well, Matt, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for all of this, and I look forward to hearing more. I'll be listening from New York.
Well, it's sad to see you go, but thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a blast.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and he talks with us about a few of those songs. You will find Wild's full list at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week. We get help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. And we also heard from Susan Benz from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Revy, our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski, our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.